Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside. Special episode SP28, Spring Holiday Show for 2012. Hello, welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Gary.
And I'm Ruth. If you want to chat to us, you can do that using Twitter or on Facebook or in our forums. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can email us at garyandruth@celticmythpodshow.com.
Good stuff. And in this episode, we once again have some super music, amazing poetry, some interesting information about St. Bridget and the Irish goddess Breed,
and a fabulous excerpt from Ellen Evett Hopman's book, The Druid Isle, which is a follow-on from her amazing book, Priestess of the Forest.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. Mm. Didn't we read an excerpt from Priestess of the Forest earlier on? What was it? Episode SP06, I think.
Yes, we did, actually. And if you want to remind yourself how the story goes, pop back and have a listen to SP06.
Do you realise that was recorded in 2008?
Good grief. I didn't realise it was that long ago. It doesn't seem that long, does it?
Time flies when you're having fun. And now we're just about to start the Welsh stories.
Yes, and I'm really looking forward to those.
We also have some special guests helping us with the stories. But more about that in the next show. Now let's get on with this one. What have we got first?
Well, let's kick off with Dave the Bard singing The Song of Arwen from his album Herne's Apprentice.
Hear me now, take heed. blood, and I am your bone. It is you who are broken. You are part of me. There is no separation. So dance, sing, and be free.
That was The Song of Arwen by Dave the Bard.
A little birdie told me that Dave might be changing his identity for another project in the near future.
Oh, yes. And it's not the new Spirit of Albion film either.
I wonder what it is.
Mm.
On that note, we'll be bringing you the interviews with actors and with Dave and with film director Gary Andrews in the very near future. So keep an ear out for those special shows on the Spirit of Albion film.
So, on with the show. Now it's time for some fabulous information from the Carmina Gadelica on traditions and beliefs surrounding Bride, St. Bridget.
Adapted from the Carmina Gadelica, Volume 1 by Alexander Carmichael, 1900.
Sleuntrach Bride, the genealogy of Bridget.
The genealogy of Bride was current among people who had a latent belief in its efficacy. Other hymns to Bride were sung on her festival, but nothing now remains except the names and fragments of the words. The names are curious and suggestive, such as Prayer of Bride, Staff of Bride, Lorica of Bride, Mantle of Bride, well, and others. St. Bridget's Day is the 1st of February, New Style, or the 13th according to the Old Style, which is still much in use in the Highlands. It was a day of great rejoicing and jubilation in olden times, and gave rise to innumerable sayings such as Feast of the Bride, Feast of the Maiden, Melodious Bride of the Fair Palms, Thou Bride Fair Charming. There are many legends and customs connected with Bride, some of these seem inconsistent with one another and with the character of the Saint of Kildare. These seeming inconsistencies arise from the fact that there were several Brides, Christian and pre-Christian, whose personalities have become confused in the course of centuries, the attributes of all being now popularly ascribed to one. Bride is said to preside over fire, over art, over all beauty beneath the sky and beneath the sea. And man being the highest type of ideal beauty, Bride presides at his birth and dedicates him to the Trinity. She is the Mary and the Juno of the Gael. She is much spoken of in connection with Mary, generally in relation to the birth of Christ. She was the midwife of the Mother of Nazareth in the lowly stable, and she's the midwife of all mothers in their humble homes. It is said that Bride was the daughter of poor pious parents and the serving maid in the Inn of Bethlehem. Great drought occurred in the land, and the master of the hostel went away with his cart to procure water from afar, leaving with Bride a stoup of water and a bannock of bread to sustain her till his return. The man left injunctions with Bride not to give food or drink to anyone, as he'd left only enough for herself, and not to give shelter to anyone against his return. As Bride was working in the house, two strangers came to the door. The man was old, with brown hair and grey beard, and the woman was young and beautiful, with oval face, straight nose, blue eyes, red lips, small ears and golden brown hair, which fell below her waist. They asked the serving maid for a place to rest, for they were footsore and weary, for food to satisfy their hunger, and for water to quench their thirst. Breed could not give them shelter, but she gave them of her own bannock, and of her own stoup of water, of which they partook at the door. And having thanked Breed, the strangers went their way, while Breed gazed wistfully and sorrowfully after them. She saw that the sickness of life was on the young woman of the lovely face, and her heart was sore that she had not the power to give them the shade from the heat of the sun, and cover from the cold of the dew. When Breed returned into the house in the darkening of the twilight, what was stranger to her to see than that of the bannock of bread was whole, and the stoup of water full, as they had been before? She did not know under the land of the world what she'd say or what she would do. The food and the water of which she herself had given them, and had seen them partake, without a bit or a drop lacking from them. When she recovered from her wonderment, Breed went out to look after the two who had gone their way. She could see no more of them, but she saw a brilliant golden light over the stable door. And knowing that it was not a meteor of death, she went into the stable and was in time to aid and minister to the Virgin Mother and to receive the child into her arms. For the strangers were Joseph and Mary, and the child was Jesus Christ, the Son of God, come to earth and born in the stable of the hostel of Bethlehem. When the child was born, Breed put 3 drops of water from the spring of pure water onto his forehead, in the name of God, in the name of Jesus, in the name of Spirit. When the master of the inn was returning home and ascending the hill on which his house stood, he heard the murmuring music of a stream flowing past his house, and he saw the light of a bright star above his stable door. He knew from these signs that the Messiah was come, and that Christ was born, for it was in the seership of the people that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, would be born in Bethlehem, the town of David. And the man rejoiced with exceeding joy at the fulfillment of the prophecy, and he went to the stable and worshipped the new Christ, whose infant cradle was the manger of the horses. Thus Breed is called the aid woman of Mary. In this connection, and in consequence thereof, she is called the foster mother of Christ, and godmother of Jesus Christ of the bindings and blessings. Christ again is called the foster son of Breed, the foster son of Breed of the blessings, or little fosterling of Breed, a term of endearment. Fostership amongst the Highlanders was a peculiarly close and tender tie, more close and more tender even than blood. There are many proverbs on the subject, such as, blood to the 20th, fostership to the 100th degree. A church in Islay is called the Church of the Fosterling.
When a woman is in labour, the midwife, or the woman next to her in importance, goes to the door of the house and, standing on the doorstep with her hands on the jambs, softly beseeches Breed to come.
Breed, Breed, come in. I welcome this truly late. Give thou relief to the world, and give the confession of the treaty.
When things go well, it indicates that Breed is present and is friendly to the family, and when they go ill, that she is absent and offended. Following the action of Breed at the birth of Christ, the aid woman dedicates the child to the Trinity by letting 3 drops of clear, cold water fall on his forehead. On Breed's Eve, the girls of the townland fashion a sheaf of corn into the likeness of a woman. They dress and deck the figure with shining shells, sparkling crystals, primroses, snowdrops, and any other greenery they may obtain. In the mild climate of the Outer Hebrides, several species of plants continue to flower during the winter, unless the season be exceptionally severe. The gales of March are there the destroyers of plant life. Especially bright shell or chrysalis is placed over the heart of the figure. This is called the guiding star of Breed, and typifies the star over the stable door of Bethlehem, which led Breed to the infant Christ. The girls call the figure Brid, bride, little Brid, and carry it in a procession, singing the song of the beauteous bride, virgin of a thousand charms. The Brid maiden band are clad in white and have their hair down, symbolising purity and youth. They visit every house, and every person is expected to give a gift to Brid and to make obeisance to her. The gift may be a shell, a spar, a crystal, a flower, or a bit of greenery to decorate the person of Brid. Mothers, however, give a Brid bannock, a Brid cheese, or a Brid roll of butter. Having made the round of the place, the girls go to a house to make the Brid feast. They bar the door and secure the windows of the house, and set Brid where she may see and be seen by all. Presently, the young men of the community come humbly asking for permission to honour Brid. After some parleying, they are admitted and make obeisance to her. Much dancing and singing and thud of frolic are indulged in by the young men and maidens during the night. As the grey dawn of the day of Brid breaks, they form a circle and sing a hymn of beauteous Brid, choice foster mother of Christ. They then distribute the fragments of the feast, practically the whole, for they have partaken very sparingly, in order to have more to give among the poor women of the place. A similar practice prevails in Ireland. The churn staff, not the corn sheaf, is fashioned into the form of a woman and called Little Brid. The girls come clad in their best, and the girl who has the prettiest dress gives it to Bridog. An ornament, something like a Maltese cross, is affixed to the breast of the figure. The ornament is composed of straw, beautifully and artistically interlaced by the deft fingers of the maidens of Brid. It's called the little star of Brid. Pins, needles, bits of stones, bits of straw and other things are given to Brid as gifts, and food by the mothers. Customs assume the complexion of their surroundings, as fishes, birds and beasts assimilate the colours of their habitats. The seas of the rough bounds in which the cult of Brid has longest lived abound in beautiful iridescent shells and the mountains in bright sparkling stones, and these are utilised to adorn the icon of Brid. In other districts where the figure of Brid is made, there are no shining shells, no brilliant crystals, and the girls decorate the image with artistically interlaced straw. Older women are also busy on the eve of Brid, and great preparations are made to celebrate her day, which is the first day of spring. They make an oblong basket in the shape of a cradle, which they call the bed of Brid. It's embellished with much care. Then they take the choice sheaf of corn, generally oats, and fashion it into the form of a woman. They deck this icon with gay ribbons from the loom, sparkling shells from the sea, and bright stones from the hill. All the sunny, sheltered valleys around are searched for primroses, daisies, and other flowers that open their eyes in the morning of the year. This lay figure is called Brid, the icon of Brid. When it is dressed and decorated with all the tenderness and loving care that the women can lavish upon it, one woman goes to the door of the house. Standing on the step with her hands on the jambs, calls softly into the darkness. To this, a ready woman behind replies, "Let Brid come in. Brid is welcome." The women at the door again address Brid.
"Brid, Brid, come in. Thy bed is made. Prepare thy house in the vicinity."
The women then place the icon of Brid with great ceremony in the bed they've so carefully prepared for her. They place a small, straight white wand, the bark being peeled off, beside the figure. This wand is variously called the little rod of Brid, the little wand of Brid, and the birch of Brid. The wand is generally of birch, broom, bramble, white willow, or other sacred wood, crossed or bandwood being carefully avoided.
A similar rod was given to the kings of Ireland at their coronation, and to the lords of the Isles at their instatement. It was straight to typify justice, and white to signify peace and purity. Bloodshed was not to be needlessly caused. The women then level the ashes of the hearth, smoothing and dusting them over carefully. Occasionally, the ashes, surrounded by a roll of cloth, are placed on a board to safeguard them against disturbance from drafts or other contingencies. In the early morning, the family closely scan the ashes. If they find the marks of the wand of Breed, they rejoice. But if they find Longbreed, the footprint of Breed, their joy is very great. For this is a sign that Breed was present with them during the night and is favourable to them, and that there is increase in family, in flock, and in field during the coming year. Should there be no marks on the ashes and no traces of Breed's presence, the family are dejected. It is to them a sign that she is offended and will not hear their call. To propitiate her and gain her ear, the family offer oblations and burn incense. The oblation generally is a cockerel, some say a pullet, buried alive near the junction of three streams, and the incense is burnt on the hearth when the family retire for the night. It is said in Ireland that Breed walked before Mary with a lighted candle in each hand when she went up to the temple for purification. The winds were strong on the temple heights, and the tapers were unprotected, yet they did not flicker nor fail. From this incident, Breed is called Breed of Brightness. This day is occasionally called the Feast Day of Breed of the Candles, but more generally, the Feast Day of Mary of the Candles, Candlemas Day. The serpent is supposed to emerge from its hollow among the hills on St. Breed's Day, and a propitiatory hymn was sung to it. Only one verse of this hymn has been obtained, apparently the first. It differs in different localities.
Early on bride's morn, the serpent shall come from the hole. I will not molest the serpent, nor will the serpent molest me.
One of the most curious customs of Breed's Day was the pounding of the serpent in effigy. The following scene was described to the writer by one who was present. I was one of several guests, and the hospital host, Mr. John, told me of Witness Sky. One of my fellow guests was Mrs. MacLeod, widow of Major MacLeod of Stein, daughter of Flora MacDonald. Mrs. MacLeod was known among her friends as a Major Anne. She combined the warmest of hearts with the sternest of manners, and was the admiration of old and young for her wit, wisdom, and generosity. And when told that her son had fallen in a duel with the celebrated Glengarry, the Ivor MacIvor of Waverley, she exclaimed,
"Good thou art, my son, thou the white love of thy own mother. Better the hero's death than the craven's life. The brave dies but once, the coward many times."
In a company of noblemen and gentlemen at Dunvegan Castle, Mrs. MacLeod, then in her 88th year, danced the rail of horse and other rails, jigs, and thrust plays as lightly as a girl in her teens. Whatever she was, both strove to show Mrs. MacLeod attention and to express the honour in which she was held. She accepted all these honours and attentions with grace and dignity, and without any trace of vanity or self-consciousness. And one morning, breakfast at Witness, someone remarked, "This was the day of Breed."
"The day of Breed? The day of Breed?"
repeated Mrs. MacLeod meditatively, with a dignified bow of apology, rose from the table. All watched her movements with eager curiosity. Mrs. MacLeod went to the fireside and took up the tongs and a bit of peat and walked out to the doorstep. She then took off her stocking and put the peat into it and pounded it with the tongs. And as she pounded the peat on the step, she intoned her own, Arun, only one verse of which I can remember.
"This is the day of Breed. The queen will come from the mound. I will not touch the queen, nor will the queen touch me."
Having pounded the peat and replaced her stocking, Mrs. MacLeod returned to the table.
apologising for her earnestness and not remembering the day earlier in the morning. I could not make out whether Mrs. McLeod was serious or acting, for she was a consummate actress and the delight of young and old. There are many curious ceremonies and traditions in connection with Breed were told that morning, but I do not remember them.
The pounding in the stocking of the peat, representing the serpent, would indicate destruction rather than worship. Perhaps the bruising of the serpent's head. Probably, however, the ceremony is older and designed to symbolise something now lost. Gaelic lore is full of sayings about serpents. These indicate close observation.
He has the ear of a serpent. The witch woman is crooked as a serpent. The tail is the least harmful of thee. The trick of the serpent venomous, though thy skin be smooth.
Breed is said to preside over different seasons of the year, and to bestow their functions upon them according to their respective needs. Some call January the dead month, some December, while some apply the terms of three dead months, the dead quarter, and the dead quarter of the year to the winter months, when nature is asleep. Breed, with her white wand, is said to breathe life into the mouth of the dead winter, and to bring him to open his eyes to the tears and smiles, the sighs and the laughter of spring. Venom of the cold is said to tremble for its safety on Breed's Day and flee for its life on St. Patrick's Day. There is a saying, The raven is the first bird to nest, closely followed by the mallard and the rook. And it is affirmed that
as far as the wind shall enter the door on the first day of Breed, the floor shall enter the door on the first day of Patrick.
From these traditional observations, it will be seen that Breed and her services are near to the hearts and the lives of the people. In some phases of her character, she is much more to them than Mary is. But did you know Dungarvan Castle, that it talks about that Lady MacLeod was living in? Yeah. Did you know that's the castle that holds the fairy flag?
No.
It is, yeah.
No, the fairy flag is the one that was traditionally marking a truce between mortals and fae.
That's right.
Is
and,
that right?
And yes, if it's waved on the day of battle, in a battle, that side will win. It was often to Winston Churchill to use by the, I think it was the MacLeod family. To wave to
does,
use
does
the
MacLeod family still have it now?
I don't know if they still have it, but they did during the Second World War.
Fascinating. I thought it was interesting how the woods were chosen for the wand of Breed, and I wonder where they relate to the Oham.
Interesting.
What's that about band woods
or crossed woods?
Crossed woods.
Yes,
yeah.
I don't know. I wonder if that's the hawthorn. And did you notice something else?
What?
Something else that crossed my mind during that. Was the serpents that come out of the holes. But they come out of the hollow hills. Did you notice that?
I thought that, yes.
I wondered
whether it was a reference to Fae.
Yeah, or to the she, at least.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm.
The other thing is, I knew that Bridget was a midwife to Christ, but I never knew the whole story, so that was actually quite interesting.
Breed must have been a well-loved and respected goddess for the church to give her such a role in the Nativity.
Absolutely. And somewhere she's kind of got mixed up with the Christian mythology, which is, actually, it's quite an honour, isn't it?
It is.
If you think about it.
She's not going away.
No, absolutely not. Well, the interesting thing is we see versions of her name all across the British Isles. Brigantia, Brigadona, Brigon, Brigandu, Braid, and the Welsh Brith. So belief in her was pretty far and wide, really.
I think we'll come across her in another form in the Welsh tales.
Really? I can't wait.
Well, you'll just have to see, won't you? Time for some more music.
Yes, certainly. What have we got?
Well, we've got a lovely song by Spiral Dance from their album The Quickening called Into the Green.
The wind in the willows. Oh, the winter nights have been so cold and long. Blows through the willows and taunts us with her icy song. I hide in my pillows, keep my nose from the cold night air. But out by the willows, I know the sign of spring is almost there. Where are you? Where are you? Where have you gone, Jack in the Green? I'll find you, I'll find you, I'll seek you out where the winter's been. Look for you, look for you, hiding out in the summer land. Where are you? Where are you? Where are you, Jack? Beneath the willows, I watch the clouds in the summer sky. Beneath the willows, I'll dream to where the green man lies. There I will follow along the path of his leafy feet. I am the willow, and I'm dancing in fields of meadow sweet. Where are you? Where are you? Where have you gone, Jack in the Green? I'll find you, I'll find you, I'll seek you out where the winter's been. Look for you, look for you, hiding out in the summer land. Where are you? Where are you? Where are you, Jack, my green man?
Me under my pillow, I found the seed his love for me.
back in the grain. I'll find you, I'll find you, I'll seek you out where the winter's been. Look for you, look for you, hiding out in the summer land. Where are you? Where are you? Where are you, Jack, my green man?
That's was Into the Green by Spiral Dance. And now I'd like to introduce a small poem penned by our very own Ruthie and accompanied by some fantastic harp music by Scott Hoy with a medley of tunes, Eleanor Poor and Fanny Plunkett. And you can find out more details about Scott in the show notes. So let's go over to our Ruthie now with her poem, Bridges of the Gael.
Bridges of the Gael. I am Bridget of the Gael. I am daughter of the mighty Dagda, our beloved Allfather. I am many things to many men. I'm there at the beginning of every bright spring to see the ewes birth their first lambs. I'm there to bring your babies into the world and to ease the path of those departing. I am there to share your grief and keen your lost loved ones. In my fire I forge your weapons. As bright arrow, I defend you in righteous battle. I am the lady of newborn streams and recently dug wells. I watch over your newborn calves and lambs. I am lady of the forge, the plough, and your cooking fire, where all things begin and end, and your tales are told. As the lady of your hearth, I bring you warmth, love, and strength. I whistle a melody to guide you home in the dark. I am the lady of verse and poetry, and the mysteries of divination and prophecy. Yet I'm also the maiden who favours animals and speaks with peace and healing in her hands. I am the lady of all high places, high-rising flames, highlands, hill forts and uplands, and the goddess who brings exalted wisdom, perfection, craftsmanship, druidic knowledge, and skill in battle. I am the saint and goddess of home and hearth, to both pagan and Christian alike. I am the lady of Pluties and holy wells, sacred flames and healing. The lighting of candles and fire in my name represents the increasing power of the sun. I am the maiden divine, bringing the warmth of spring in my wake.
That was beautiful. She's a busy lady, though, isn't she?
She certainly seems to be. Did you know she's a goddess of bees and honey, too?
Oh, does that include mead?
Oh, I'm sure it does.
Well, how about we have a glass in our honour while listening to the next song?
Hey, that sounds a great idea. Have a listen to Summer Will Come Round Again from the album Summer Solstice by Jennifer Cutting's Ocean Band.
We dream of the sunlight painting the sheen on the dragonfly's wing. Youthful, we dream of adventure, restless to start on the quest, flying the heights of ambition, aching with pride to be seen with the best. Stranded, we dream of the tide. Breathless, we wait the arrival of the kiss that will waken the slumbering bride. Spin all your dreams on the wheel of the year. Summer will come round again. Open your eyes and it's already here. Thirsty, we dream. In darkness we dream of the sunlight, painting the sheen on the dragonflies away. Painting the sheen on each dragonfly away.
That was the fabulous Summer Will Come Round Again by Jennifer Cutting's Ocean Band. And you can find out more about them in the show notes.
And they've got a wide range, haven't they?
They certainly have, yeah.
Superb, superb. That was a lovely song, and you can just feel the warmth of lazy summer days.
No, honey, that's the mead.
Oh.
I'm joking. It's a beautiful song, and I'm fairly sure we'll be hearing more of Jennifer Cutting in future shows.
And now for our story. This is an excerpt from the wonderful book, The Druid Isle, and it's book two in an amazing trilogy written by Ellen Everett Hopman.
Ellen's third book in the trilogy is released this month, March. It's called Priestess of the Fire Temple, A Druid's Tale, and I can't wait to read it. I loved the first two books.
Yes. Well, we wish Ellen well with her book release, and let's get ourselves in the mood for her new book by listening to an excerpt from The Druid Isle by Ellen Everett Hopman.
The Druid Isle.
Ethna, Ruath and Aoife set out for Irathacht the morning after their confrontation with Cordlaw. To help him save face, they did not return to the Hall of the Ardrí. Instead, Gunya sent a messenger to tell him they'd gone. At the gates, Gunya intoned an ancient blessing to protect them in their travels.
Bless the pathways on which you go. Bless the earth beneath your sleeves. Bless you as you go over the seas. Against drowning, against peril, against spell. Against wounding, against fight. No brand shall burn thee, no arrow wound thee. You shall go and return triumphant, as the sun who rises victorious above the dark sea of night.
Gunya kissed Aoife's cheek.
Go with joy, my child. The whole world is before you.
She turned to Ruath and embraced him.
May your warrior's heart keep you strong.
Lastly, she put her arms around Ethna.
You are the breath of this nether. You are the priestess I would have the druid for.
Ethna, feeling the fragile bones in her arms, wept and held Gunya close.
Mother of my childhood, I carry you in my heart as the sun rises and the moon sails the sky. You live through every word I teach.
They held each other close, and Gunya put her hand to Ethna's cheek, pulled herself away, and walked steadily back to the Nevith. They travelled in their accustomed way, begging shelter for the night at isolated farmsteads, bartering with tales for their supper. When the weather was fine, Ethna and Aoife foraged for wild greens, while Ruath hunted or fished. And then they ate wild game roasted on green sticks and slept around an open fire. Aoife had no clear idea where they were going or why. Ethna and Ruath were loath to tell her the purpose of their journey north until the last moment, to spare her from fear. When she asked, they simply told her to wait, to keep silent. Druid trained, she was patient. To cover their tracks in case Cordla had second thoughts about vengeance, Ruath always cut a square of turf and carefully lifted it aside, and then built their fire on the exposed soil. And the next morning, he meticulously replaced the turf leaving no visible trace of their passing. It was an old trick of the Fiona. Within a few weeks, they'd reached the shores of Loch Fuil. Ruth left Aoife with Ethna in a secluded cove and set out to barter for a curach in the settlement nearby. While they waited, Ethna and Aoife settled themselves on the sun-warmed rocks. Ethna knew it was time.
Aoife, have you heard the tale of Bran, son of Feeble, and the Blessed Isle?
I've heard that story, but it was many, many sun-turnings ago.
Then let me refresh your memory. Bran of Feeble was walking out one day beyond the gates of his wrath, when he heard a sweet music that magically put him to sleep. Upon waking, he discovered that he had a silver apple branch in his hand, with sprouting silver leaves, fruits, and blossoms. He carried that apple branch back to his dome, and the gates were locked behind him. When he entered his great hall and joined his warriors and their ladies, a strange woman materialized in their midst, singing of Arwen y Loch, an isle where there is no sorrow and no want. She sang of the white seahorses of Manannan na Glia that course around its shores, and an ancient tree at his centre, ever in flower, filled with singing birds. She sang that it is a place without sickness, suffering or death, a place without winter, a place of peace, health and happiness. When her song was done, the apple branch threw out of Bran's hand into the woman's hand, and then she disappeared.
She sounds like one of the she,
said Aoife in a logical tone.
Some would say that. Others would say she was a messenger from the other world, describing an island where the dead go in the Western Sea. But what if I told you that such a place actually exists in the mortal world?
Aoife could see that Ethna wasn't kidding, and her eyes grew round in amazement. At that moment, Ruath appeared.
I found one, and it's waiting on the shore,
he said to Ethna.
Found what?
Aoife asked. Ethna and Ruath looked at each other.
He has found a curragh to take you to sea,
said Ethna quietly, holding Aoife's hands to reassure her.
I don't understand.
She looked from one to the other.
For your safety, but much more for the survival of all Druid, you must go.
Ethna kept hold of her hand.
But what about you? You're the keeper of the ancient ways. I cannot go alone.
No, Aoife. Your journey begins here. The gods are calling you. We must stay here and tend to the people. We'll go back to the forest school and teach the children. They have much learning yet before them.
Ethna held herself firmly. She could allow no doubt, no grief to turn her aside from setting Aoife on her way.
No!
Aoife wailed.
You cannot leave me. I will not be away from you.
She clung to Ethna. Ruath put his arms around them both and relayed Gunya's instructions.
It is no longer possible for you to finish your druid training at the Neveth of the Ardri. Kor'lor has disgraced himself, and the new religion of the god Issa has encroached upon the island. We've gone into hiding in the forest just to keep our teachings and traditions alive. But there's an island in the north called Inish Nandruisnya by some, and Inish Iroch by others. It's the holiest island of the druid, reachable only by those specially chosen by the gods. To finish your studies and be a true mistress of the Filidech, you must go there. There is no other way.
But alone?
She asked, terror gorging her throat.
It's the only way. For uncounted sun cycles, it's been so. The elders teach that when a curragh is put out to sea from Loch Fuil in the Equus month, the currents and winds will conspire to bring it to that magical place. And to be found worthy, you must go in confidence, without oars.
Aoife stared neither at Ethna nor Ruath, but into some middle space, and a sorrowing despair came over her.
You mean to set me adrift beyond the ninth wave like a common criminal? You intend to cast me out in the Kinneth of Weir to meet my death? Or wash up as a slave on some foreign shore?
She shuddered, covering her face with her hands. The reason for their arduous journey was at last sinking in. Now Aoife understood why Ethna and Ruath had been so grim and silent. It was beyond imagining.
Aoife,
Ethna began.
We took our lives into our own hands when we left the protection of the Neveth so many sun turnings ago. You were too young to realize the courage it took. We were outcasts, courtesy of the Christithum missionaries who swayed the Fliath and the Ardri to their beliefs. It's a wonder they didn't come and tear down our school, the way they chopped down the sacred trees and destroyed our groves and altars in every district.
But you had the protection of Ruath and the Fianna. You didn't have to stand alone.
Aoife wailed, striving fiercely for self-control. Her teeth were chattering and she felt very cold.
That is so. But you're destined for another fate. The greater the test, the greater the reward. Everything we do now is for the sake of generations to come. All that you have learned, all that you have been given to this moment, was passed down to you from those who went before. It's your turn to shine like a star in the dark night. Did you think that all this learning was for yourself alone?
Aoife pulled her head up and looked directly at Ethna.
No. I carry the story so that others may know. I am ashamed.
There is no shame in being frightened. The fiercest warrior knows fear before battle. Courage comes from looking past the fear. I've seen you do that.
He smiled at Aoife.
Remember your swordplay? Remember how you stood your ground even against several of the bigger boys? That was courage past fear.
Aoife's eyes filled with tears, but she gave Ruath a small smile.
I didn't think I would be called upon to offer my life for the people so soon.
It's in the hands of the gods whether you'll arrive at the Druid Isle. You might wash up on another shore, and then that'll be your fate. There's no way to predict. You must be a warrior in this quest,
said Ruath, thinking of the times he had willingly offered his own life's blood for the protection of others.
A spiritual warrior,
added Ethna. Aoife saw that there was no backing away. She felt transparent, already half a ghost.
I surrender myself to the will of gods, the druid, and the sea.
Ethna suddenly grabbed Aoife and held her in a fierce embrace.
You are my daughter, Aoife. You are of me in mind and spirit and heart. Know your strength, for it is great. I know. No, I will never fail in sending you protection.
She kissed Aoife's tear-streaming face, her own face wet. They walked her to the shore and gave her one day's supply of food and water. Aoife climbed into the boat, and they swam the little Coruch beyond the breakers, setting it adrift. Ethna swam back to the shore and then stood in the surf, weeping. The memory of another child lost in the water nearly made her fling herself into the waves to catch Aoife back. But Ruath held her tight, his own grief beyond speech. They stood in the cold shadows watching until the tiny vessel floated out of sight. The first day, the sea was choppy, and the little Coruch bounced along the wave crests. Each time the boat crested a swell and then nosed into a trough, Aoife was misted with salty sea spray. But she was protected by boiled wool mittens, a cowled cape, and thick socks. The wool had been lightly soaked in oil, a fisherman's trick to ward off the sea. Ruath had bartered for these when he got the boat from a fishing family. She had a wooden cup for bailing and an oiled leather tarp in case of a squall. She'd carefully rationed a little leather bag of water and a store of oat bread and cheese. As the sun set, she surrendered to yet another bout of tears. No one to hear her, except the fish and the birds.
What do you want of me?
She called to the gods as she pounded her thigh.
Why me? I'm no great poet. A prophet with a tongue that cannot lie. I am just me. Just me with everything I love taken away.
Eva sobbed and hugged herself, feeling the emptiness spreading around her, feeling her small self in the middle of a vast, terrifying nothing. Her only comfort left was the stone that Gunya had given her when she was in the Neveth. She clutched it in her tear-stained fingers and curled into the bottom of the boat as best she could, crying herself to sleep, rocked by the rhythm of the waves. She woke at dawn to watch the red-orange orb of the sun melt gradually into gold and then yellow against a bluer and bluer sky.
Grian, help me!
She called out to the rising queen of the day. She sat for hour upon hour, surrounded by only the sea and sky. No birds dipped from the wind. No fish broke the water's surface. Oh, her back and shoulders ached. The sun beat down and the waves pulled inexorably at the boat. And without warning, the ocean flattened into glassy calm. The wind stopped. Sound didn't exist. Aoife looked all around her. There was nothing. She pulled into herself and scanned the waters again. In the distance was a fast approaching chariot with horse and rider, coursing towards her atop the glassy still sea. She dared not move, unsure whether this was a dream, a waking dream, or a vision. She squeezed her eyes once and opened them again to see if it was a fear-induced hallucination, a trick of the light. But the image persisted and grew larger. There was no mistaking it. As the chariot drew nearer, the sea sprouted purple flowers, as if the boat rested on a heather-filled moor. But Aoife was too terrified to touch the flowers. And then a shimmering silver mist rose on every side, blotting out the horizon. The chariot and the rider pulled up before her, a man with dark flowing hair and beard, and eyes the colour of a winter's sky. The prancing horse was tall and proud, with a thick mane, and a tail so long it swept the field of flowers. As the man studied her face, his billowing cloak changed colours, as if registering his thoughts. It shimmered blue-green as a clear lake on a summer day. It silvered as moonlight. It darkened purple and black as twilight. An intricately crafted sword hung by his side, glowing with its own light.
I am the gatekeeper of Ennis Nadroesnia. No one may approach except through me,
he said.
What is it that you want?
I don't know,
Aoife cried. What was she supposed to say? What was she supposed to do?
What is your purpose?
The man pointedly asked.
I have been sent to learn.
It was all she could think to say. She didn't know whether she should look directly at the rider or look away. She didn't know which would show respect. She was overwhelmed and shaken, beyond her depth. There'd been no time to prepare.
That answer is good. I have heard worse. This is the place of all knowledge.
He reached the floor of the chariot, lifted up a small harp, and began to play. As he struck the first chord, Aoife's fear melted. The man spoke gently to the accompaniment of his harp.
To obtain wisdom, you must drink from the well of five streams. The well is eternal and inexhaustible. The well exists under the sea, and yet also within you. You have carried it with you through birth and death, through countless lifetimes. The five streams are your senses. You must drink from the streams and from the well itself. Only then will you attain knowledge. Remember my words. You must drink from the spiritual source and also from your own experience. Do you understand?
I think I do,
she answered.
You are young in this life. It will become clearer after you have finished your training.
How did you know?
She asked, amazed that the stranger had divined the purpose of her journey.
I will open the veil for you. You have a good heart, and you may pass.
He said nothing more. As the silver mists parted, Aoife was surprised to see a small, rocky island in the distance. The chariot was turning. The man was leaving, heading back to the open ocean.
Who are you?
She cried out as the choppy waves and winds reappeared.
Manon MacLean,
he shouted, his voice in the foam chariot and horse already fading into the waves and the sea winds. Stunned by the encounter with the god of the sea, Aoife sat frozen as her tiny craft nosed inexorably towards land, seemingly with a mind of its own. She saw a huge rock directly ahead, jutting out of the swelling surf just before the shoreline.
Gods, please don't let me crash into that rock,
she prayed. With no oars, she was helpless. The wind and waves would take her wherever they willed. In the distance, she could make out a lone figure with long white hair standing on the beach. He appeared to be dressed in a knee-length blue robe. As the Cúrach drew closer to the rock, she wondered if she would have to jump and tried to quickly decide what to take with her if she did. She was just removing the wool cloak when the boat was sucked into a whirlpool spiralling around a huge stone. Oh, too late! If she jumped now, she would be dragged under. She clutched the sides of the Cúrach in terror.
Help me!
She said to whatever force or being might be listening. The boat was captured in the tiny maelstrom and swirled desolate around the rock and then spun out of the spiralling waters just as quickly into the frothing surf, arrowing straight for shore. Curiously, the figure in blue made no offer of assistance. He just stood there, leaning on a carved staff, watching. The Cúrach rode a last wave onto the pebbled beach and came to a grinding stop right at the feet of the waiting man. Aoife could see that he was a Druid. His forehead was shaved from ear to ear in the Druid tonsure, and he wore a golden torque which further advertised his status. The man's face was lined by age, yet strangely youthful. Goodwill and humour radiated from him in waves. But he still hadn't moved to help her.
The gods be with you and welcome to Inishnandroisnya, he said. I am Mavulgorth.
He finally reached out his hand to help her step out of the Cúrach.
I was waiting to see from which side of the rock you would arrive. It's lucky you came to shore, Dessel. The gods have accepted you and approve of your coming.
What would have happened if I'd have come the other way? To the Vale?
She asked, bewildered.
We would have welcomed you just the same. Send you back after a few days' rest and a meal. May I offer you a cup of joy? It's our custom to welcome visitors with a drink of hospitality.
He reached into a large willow basket that was next to him on the pebbled beach and lifted out a corked stone bottle and a small golden cup. He opened the bottle, poured a thin stream of golden liquid into the cup and presented it to her formally.
Welcome to the island,
he said as she sipped the intoxicating cup of mead. The man was relaxed, friendly, and not at all surprised by her arrival. Apparently, this was not the first time a stranger had appeared from the ocean without any oars.
Wow, what a great story. I bet you want to know what happens next, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm afraid you'll have to read the book. All of Ellen's books are available on Amazon. And you can find the rest of the details
in the show notes. In the show notes. What a packed show it's been.
It certainly has. And we're not quite finished yet.
Excellent.
We've got one more piece of music to go.
Ah, what we got?
Well, it's a song I thought would fit in very well considering the ending of the story excerpt we've just heard. So to play us out, here's Amagin by The Dolmen.
my stag a 7 times. I am a flood across a plain. I am a wind on a deep lake. I am a tear the sun lets fall. I am a hawk above the cliff. Yen ten tesla petra. I am a spear, the voice for blood. I am a salmon in a pool. I am a lure from paradise. I am a hill where poets walk. I am the womb of every hole. Yen ten tesla petra.
Amagin by the Fantastic Dolmen from their album Songs and Music from the Druids of Stonehenge.
What a great album. And you can find out more about the Dolmen in the show notes.
Brilliant. Is there any more?
No. Sadly, now we really have come to a close.
So we'd like to wish you all many blessings and Húvaur. I'll be able to say that soon.
Húvaur.
Húvaur.
Perfect. Blimey, that was hard work. And a propitiatory and a propish blim 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 blim.
And a what?
And a blim. Mm,
right.
And
then.
A propim blim. One of the most curious customs of Bree.
You laughing at me, woman?
That was almost a Carry On sketch, that one.
What is your purpose? What is your favourite colour? What is the average airspeed of a swallow?
Sorry.
Feeling okay?
Does that mean a quick Python moment?
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com.
You can send us an email or some voice feedback to Gary and Ruth at CelticMythPodShow.com. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. You can find them at www.sfhounds.com.
We'd also like to say a big thank you to Anne Bruce, Master Harper, and Keltoria, with a K, Celtic New Age Music, who have both given the show unrestricted access to their music. And thanks again go to Diane Arkenstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used as some of the transitions you've heard in this show. You'll find links to all of these wonderful artists in the show notes at shownotes.celticmythpodshow.com.